Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hear that podcast growling, mean and angry. Hear that couple shouting, it's Danger and Jay. It's Danger and Jay.
All right, welcome into the latest edition of Hear That Podcast Growling. Paul Eater Jr. and Jay Morrison of The Athletic. Excited to be with you on a Tuesday as we are fully into the off-season portion of the program. A lot to get to, though, today. Jay, how are we doing?
Great. You said Athletic. Is it Atlantic or is it Athletic?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. The Atlantic. poor the Atlantic catching shrapnel on a Friday for no reason. Yeah, it's good to be here. We'll get to that. We'll get to the T. Higgins internet debacle. The poor Atlantic and those that are unable to read or comprehend. We'll dive back into that in a little bit. Just stick around for more of that. Meanwhile, I'd like to talk about real things that, you know, the intelligent listeners of our program understand how to talk about. And so let's start here. We're going to get to the coaches on this staff. That are up for jobs, including those that are narrowing down. And one may be being announced as we speak. I don't know. We'll get to those. We're going to talk about the Joe Mixon misdemeanor aggravated menacing charge that was dismissed and some of the ins and outs of that. We are going to talk to Mike Potts, Bengals Director of College Scouting, who's going to – a portion of the interview that I had with him, talking a little bit about, you know, the building of this team, building versus sustaining, and some of the challenges on their plate and some of the successes that they feel like they've seen, and a little bit about Duke Tobin too. So excited to bring you some of that. Mo Egger is going to join us. We're going to talk about AJ Green, who retired yesterday, his career, his legacy in Cincinnati. And we're going to conclude our betting segment, of course, with him. We're going to have Arby's, where I will dive into the T. Higgins debacle that occurred on Friday. And we'll talk a little, I don't know, we'll see where else that goes. We have one more growler bet for you, too. We'll do some Super Bowl growler bet for you, and we'll get some Super Bowl picks in for you. We'll touch on all that stuff. So, like I said, a lot to get here. Jay, you're technically on vacation. I appreciate you coming off of it just to do this for the people, a man of the people.
I am. It's a staycation. I mentioned on a previous pod, my wife had foot surgery, so I'm just kind of playing nurse with her and, you know, just kind of decompressing from the season and happy to talk Bengals one day on my vacation.
Yeah. Well, if we see her screaming and yelling in the background here on YouTube, we will make sure we take a time out and make sure you take care of her. Thanks everybody that is watching on YouTube and commenting, hit the likes, subscribes, comments, all that stuff. We love having you here. Let's start with this. Coaches up for jobs, a little update there. Lou Anarumo, amongst the two believed to be only two at this point now finalists for the Arizona Cardinals job is Brian Flores, was supposed to be a third one. He has been hired by the Minnesota Vikings as their defensive coordinator. So you have Mike Kafka and Lou Anarumo both going in second interviews this week. Lou's is reportedly scheduled for Friday. So the thought being they conclude it this week, and then at some point in the near future beyond that, maybe early next week, you will get an announcement of who it will be. Obviously the Bengals would love to keep Lou Anarumo. That is no secret. He is the one that if he left, there's a little bit more challenge. There's as far as the coach and waiting defensive coordinator in waiting. But you know, Lou getting the respect that he deserves, from Arizona and a potential to step right in there and take over that head coaching gig.
We talked about it last week where if the Chiefs win the Super Bowl, then you can pretty much lock in Bengals at Chiefs for the Thursday night season opener. If the Eagles win and Lou gets this job in Arizona, maybe Bengals at Cardinals week one, Sunday night or Monday night. I think that would be an interesting matchup, and they are playing them. I don't know how much to read into this, but when you look at the list of candidates that Arizona interviewed, it was defensive heavy. Like it looks like that's the direction they wanted to go. They did. I mean, Kafka's an offensive guy, and they did talk to other offensive guys, but more so than most teams, they had a number of defensive guys that they were interviewing. So I wonder if that does make him the front runner. Obviously, it's going to come down to this interview that's later this week, but it just looking at the way they structured this job search, I think that franchise is leaning for a defensive guy, and then hoping he can bring in an offensive coordinator that can get Kyler Murray straightened out.
Monty Austin Ford is the GM over there now. They just hired him from the Titans. We mentioned this last week. People that listen to Hear That Podcast Growling might know a connection between the Tennessee Titans, where he previously was, and the Cincinnati Bengals. You saw Lou Anarumo and one of his best friends in coaching, Terrell Williams, on this episode together back in August. You know, clearly, I'm sure Terrell has made him aware of Lou Anarumo, and then maybe that helped in the very beginning of this process of getting him in the door, but maybe that was also part of this. And also, I'll understand Tennessee, Mike Vrabel. At the time he was hired, maybe a less discussed defensive-minded coach who came in with a certain attitude and style. Keep him. I mean, you know, you are very much of a product of your past and what you've seen succeed, and maybe that has shaped a little bit of this head coach search for Monty here, and trying to find his Mike Vrabel. And maybe that's who Lou Anarumo is. I don't know, but we'll see how that goes. What happens next if Lou does go is kind of a big part of the next conversation. It's hard to say. I mean, they have plans in place. They're not sitting here saying, oh, well, Lou or bust, right? I mean, they have plans in place of the direction they would go next, but there are a lot of it does get taken off the table of what your options could have been when you're this late in the process. I mean, we've seen how many of these coordinator positions fill now. Across the league. A name that I've heard, you know, that you see out there, like what happens to Vance Joseph next, right? I mean, he has a history here in Cincinnati. Bengals ownership liked him. They talked to him when they were hiring Zach Taylor as head coach. I don't get the impression that he would be in the mix here. But again, that was just a name that had been thrown out there. But I'm not in the impression that he would be in the mix here. Where they go, I think they have their plans if they need it to be, but I think the main hope still at this point is, one, they would love Lou to get the job, but if he doesn't, they'd be very happy to welcome him back to Cincinnati, as all Bengals fans sending the distress gifts to my mentions are the same way right now.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Vance Joseph, because the Bengals also blocked him from interviewing back at a time where they liked him so much they wanted to keep him around. And would they do the same with James Betcher if Lou gets that job? Because, you know, Lou has worked with Betcher in New York, and Betcher was a Cardinals defensive coordinator for 3 years, from 15 to 17. He's been a defensive coordinator with the Giants. He's had that job before. You don't want this to look like 2019, where you're going to the combine and you've got your defensive coordinator is meeting the rest of the staff for the first time. He would be the most logical promotion from within. But again, if Lou wants to take him with him, would they block that move?
All this to be seen. Let's flip over to the other side of the ball. Brian Callahan still in the mix in Indianapolis. That job, I think there's a thought we're going to hear soon. They have done an extensive search. As Zach Kiefer pointed out on Twitter this week, we are now 4 weeks into the Colts' extensive search. There is going to be no way that whoever they hire has not been thoroughly vetted. And Brian Callahan amongst the finalists there. And they wait. They wait to see what comes out, because it's Jim Irsay. Like, that's the wild card behind this, is there's no knowing for sure where it's going to land, what decision he's going to end up finally making here. Is it going to be Saturday? Is he going to go back down that route? Is it going to be one of these other guys? There's still a lot of names in the mix amongst those finalists. So everybody kind of sits and waits to see who that's going to be. Again, you could be listening to this right now, and it may already be out who they have picked. But as we record at this specific moment, and it heads out into the internet, still unknown, Brian Callahan in the mix. Connected to that, Dan Pitcher going to go to Tampa, interview, a second interview in person with the Bucs, having done a Zoom. We mentioned this again last week. It's, you know, the idea is Dan Pitcher is the offensive coordinator in waiting, potentially here in Cincinnati, and could take over that job if Brian Callahan got the head coaching gig in Indianapolis. If Brian Callahan stays, you would think Dan Pitcher, certainly if he could got offered somewhere, which he has opportunities, would probably be moving on to take that job. So the Bengals would be in need of a quarterback's coach either way.
Yeah. Is there anyone outside of Indianapolis more interested in the timing of when that's going to get announced than Dan Pitcher? Because that certainly would affect his future. Is there an unwritten rule where you don't make an announcement on a new coach or anything major within a certain window of the Super Bowl? I know nobody's going to do it on Super Bowl Sunday, but it feels like as it gets later in the week that you don't typically hear these kind of things. It's just another reason why it feels like that Colts decision is coming very soon. It could be today as we record this on Tuesday.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a matter of teams wanting to have their moment in the news cycle. And so you don't want to get too close to the Super Bowl. But I mean, you know, we saw once you clear it, once the deck clears on Sunday, or, you know, you're still multiple days out, you still have plenty of time to own that news cycle here. So we'll see. Troy Walters also interviewed for the OC gig under D'Amico Ryans in Houston. He'll be up again. He could be somebody who could step into a more prominent role here as well if he does stick around. That's a big OC job. I mean, D'Amico Ryans being a defensive guy, that's going to be, you're probably going to be grooming a young quarterback you would expect them to draft. There's a lot happening there. That's a big gig. Troy Walters certainly would be up for it. It would be a great hire for them if they can get it. Otherwise, the Bengals will happily take him back as well. That's a little bit of the update on where all the coaches stand. It's the big thing of the moment, okay? I mean, there's a lot of other stuff that we're projecting out into the months, multiple months, years, that are on the minds and topics of everybody right now. But of this moment right now, that's what everyone's kind of got their eyes on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I saw a report where it looked like the Texans were getting really close to Ben Slowick. So I don't know if that's been named or not, but that would free Troy Walters up to stay on here, and possibly if Brian and Pitch both leave, to slide into that OC role here.
Yeah, and you never know. I mean, could end up on another staff. There's still dominoes to fall. There's still, you know, when you still have head coaching jobs out there, everything kind of holds a little bit at a standstill. Nobody wants to pull them. So, I mean, Brian Flores did, but you rarely want to see yourself pulled out of something and you miss out. People are worried about missing out, but there's a lot of people in waiting staring at those last two jobs that are still open. Most of them are coming from inside the I-275 belt. All right, let's take a second and switch gears here and hear from a sponsor.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. $5. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Let's move on to the Joe Mixon situation, which happened after we recorded last week, just to kind of recap into that. A warrant was issued for Mixon's arrest for misdemeanor aggravated menacing. Was issued and the charges were dismissed the next day with the judge in city of Cincinnati stating that they both admitted that the prosecution and the judge that they reserve the right to refile, and the victim wants to go forward with a refile if when they do. The city puts out a statement admitting, oops, yeah, we kind of botched this one pretty bad, didn't we? That investigation protocols should have been followed. They were not. Basically, they never really properly went forward with this thing getting investigated. It sat there for 2 weeks after being filed the day of the Buffalo game, and the timing being right before the Bengals would have left when this was filed. It was a road rage incident. At least all this was what was reported, with a gun being pointed out of the window that tied back to Joe Mixon. So, you know, all of this, there should be video to see. There should be other investigation that can be done. By all accounts, it appears that is what's happening now, is maybe they're actually doing the investigation they probably should have done in the first place before putting a warrant out and seeing if that leads to anything or if it does not. So that's where that sits right now. But, you know, nothing essentially comes of all, you know, what should have come. I mean, a warrant shows up for a major player's arrest. That's massive news. Turns out it amounted to nothing in that moment.
Yeah, but as you said, it could still be refiled, and it's just whatever comes of it, it's not a good look for the Bengals or for Mixon. So we'll see where the city goes with this, but you know, already you've got him listed as a possible cap casualty, and this is not going to help keep him around.
Yeah. You know, I was on with Jeremy on Fox 19 on their sports wrap on Sunday, and he kind of asked me, you know, if the Bengals made a move on Mixon, what kind of effect would what happened have? And my answer was this: you know, what we know, this was going to be a football decision, first of all, first and foremost. However, if there's information they have about what happened that we don't, that could affect it. What we have, what we know, I don't think it would have much of an effect at all. If there's more to the story that, you know, isn't out there, which is very plausible, again, we said they're looking into that, then maybe that would have a little bit of an effect on the decision. But that said, he was already going to be in that conversation before any of this happened. This was already a very serious conversation about the value of keeping Joe Mixon around or saving that, you know, $7.5 million or 10, depending on whether you're post June 1 or not, on this year's cap. Their cap meetings, you know, are still happening, ongoing, about to happen. I mean, they're just getting into that process. Their season just ended. They just got back from Mobile. And so there's a lot of stuff to be had as they hash all of that out. But I think it's going to be about football, unless, again, there's another portion of this that really is only really known to them more than it is to the public.
Yeah, it's just a wait and see at this point, because you just don't know what the city's going to do. And we talked about it. I mean, Mixon and LC were the two big likely cap casualties, and this doesn't change much.
No. Okay. Working on a story this week on sort of the personnel staff and what exactly is, you know, where they're at, where they're going forward, and how things stand from a roster building standpoint, talking to Mike Potts, also Steven Radicevich, director of pro scouting. But I so part of the interview I had with Mike, I wanted to bring you guys, chop this out, and so you can get a little bit of feel for what's going on with the Bengals inside of their personnel room, and a little bit of a reflection on how they've gotten to this point right now. So here is my little bit of my conversation with Bengals director of college scouting, Mike Potts. Let me ask you this. I've referred to the end of the season as maybe the best stretch of football in the history of this franchise. What do you think allowed the 2022 Bengals team to hit that rare gear that we just don't see NFL teams hardly ever hit?
Honestly, from a personnel perspective, I would probably have to boil it down to just the people that we've brought into the locker room. That's, I mean, I think you see it being around the team as much as you are. I think we found the right formula in terms of what we're looking for, both as a player and as a person. And we've really stuck to that. And we've got a lot of good evaluators on our scouting staff, with strong work ethic. And again, it's, we know exactly what we're looking for. And that's probably what's led to most of our success. I mean, obviously we brought in a lot of talented players, but I think the formula that we found is bringing in the right people that I know you've written about it. A lot of people have written about it, and it's out there publicly. Just guys that love football or who are tough or passionate about the game, smart. You know, there's a lot of different factors we look for, but you know, I think that's a lot of guys are talented across the league, but you want to have the right people too. And you know, with some of the guys we have leading the charge, filling in the rest of those pieces with the right people has helped us win a lot of games. So there's a lot of factors, but that's probably the one that I would boil it down to.
I know you always believe in that, and that's something you build the formula knowing that that's, you know, what can make a team win. But having watched it now over the last 2 years, is it one easier to spot exactly those types of intangible traits and how they'll play in your locker room? And two, are you more of a believer now in that, you know, in the personality aspect of things than you maybe were before watching this team over the last 2 years?
I think I've always believed that. I don't know that it's made it any easier just being, I mean, I've been around football my whole life. You know, all the guys on our staff have been, all of our coaches, you know, there's a lot of people that have been around football their whole life. It's not some secret sauce that we have. But it started probably 4 years ago, and then we're just seeing the fruits of the labor these past 2 years. So it takes time to build these things and bring in the right people. It's not like you can just have one draft. You know, you're picking at the top of the draft, you have one draft, and you bring in seven of the high character people that you want, who are also great players, and all of a sudden it just flips. But you know, we did flip it relatively quickly, but it's been I think, looking back, it's been a 4 or 5 year process to build it to where we have it right now. And we're not satisfied. We didn't win the final game. We did by no means consider this season a full success, but we're going to keep building it and you know, try to set it to where we're holding the Lombardi at the end of the year.
Let me ask you this: as you guys, you know, are in the plotting stage, you guys have done all the hard work during the season, and you're putting your, you know, your boards are together and things like that. But when you're plotting the entire picture of free agency and all the stuff in the draft and how it all fits together for the 23 Bengals, it seems like you guys have now turned the corner a little bit from build to sustain. I mean, you're always kind of doing some combination of both, but clearly now you've got a lot of things you want to keep going. Is there a difference in that? Is there any difference in the process for you guys at all? Or is it the same when you're talking about working on sustaining the level that you're at versus when you were guys in more of a build mode?
I think there's some differences, but there's also similarities. I mean, we're still looking for the same kind of people and the same talent level, and we've got the right evaluators in place to evaluate that talent. I think it's more just the cap situation, right? You know, it's just in terms of, you know, maybe we can't go out and afford those high dollar free agents or as many of those as we would have if there wasn't going to be, you know, certain players that'll eat up a good chunk of the cap. And I think it puts an emphasis on, you know, both retaining our own guys and keeping that chemistry in the locker room going. You're going to have to make some tough decisions here and there. So that's another factor that comes into it, whether to keep certain guys or move on from it. And then it just puts a premium on, we've got to continue to draft well. I think we've done well recently, but we've got to keep it going and hopefully even take it up a notch in order to have those guys on the rookie deals. And that's what we want, is we want to then pay those guys and keep our own for the second contract. But it's, you know, to answer your question, it's similar, but there's some restraints on it in terms of the cap stuff, and just, you can't fit as many guys as you would have normally.
Yeah. Duke's obviously been doing this for a long time and gone through a lot of different stages of build and sustain and draft, develop, all that stuff. What have you taken from Duke as to, you know, why he's been so successful? And maybe, you know, what is something that people don't realize about him? He's not as out there as some other, you know, prominent people who are building teams around this league. What have you taken from him, and sort of, you know, what do people maybe not realize about him and what he does?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's, you know, couldn't be an easier guy to work for in terms of, he just lets us, you know, handle our own business. There's no micromanaging. We can do, you know, we can put our own spin on anything that we're doing, whether it's from the college scouting, the pro scouting, some of the cap stuff, some of the analytics stuff that we do. So he's just going to trust us to do our work. And I think what he's built here is a staff that's very, obviously everybody knows we've got the smallest staff in the league by a significant margin, but we also use that to our advantage. There's good aspects of that in terms of, our staff is small, yes, but we're all here in the office every day if we're not out there on the road traveling, scouting. So the communication, you know, that he's put in place just with the structure of our staff and the guys that we've hired, the communication is excellent in terms of, you know, other teams may have 20 guys scattered across the country living in different locations, and we're in constant communication because of what Duke's built and the structure that he has set up here. And that really helps out. You know, the scouts are always coming to me with guys that they like, or maybe guys that they don't like, guys that we need to get extra set of eyes on to evaluate. So, you know, I think he's done a really good job, and, you know, we kind of hit rock bottom there, and you kind of, I think in a way you show your true colors and your true character when your back's up against the wall. And then we were able to build it the way that we have. And there's still more steps to be taken, but a lot of credit is deserved on his end in terms of the way that we've got everything set up, the guys that he's got on our staff and our personnel department, and you know, other areas of the organization as well. So yeah, I can't speak highly enough about him and his personal character and the job that he's done.
I mean, a lot of you see a lot of people in that type of position. They're flashy, right? They're gonna be out there. I mean, I think when he goes on the podium at the combine, it's like you can sense, like, okay, I'll do this because I have to. But a lot of other people, they want to be out there. I mean, he's always kind of fit Cincinnati in that way to me. I mean, the under the radar nature of the franchise, of the town, of the small, you know, it just. Have you kind of felt that way? That, like, is there do you embrace and enjoy that aspect of it? It's just like, there's no flash here. Like, everybody's just kind of about the work and the love of the game and the love of putting the team together. It comes from him, I would think.
Yeah, that's probably one of the, at the top of the list of things that I appreciate about him for sure. There's absolutely no ego. He's not going to be in there stubborn in our meetings and say, no, I absolutely like this guy. I'm not going to be open-minded about listening to you. There's no, you know, fraudulence out there or some public persona that he wants to put off. He's just a genuine, real person. And I think that kind of gets spread throughout the rest of our staff as well. And the guys that he's hired, and yeah, it's a great place to work in that way. And it's, again, there's no ego, so that's how you want to work. You don't want to be, you know, if you're a younger scout, you don't want to be scared to step up and say your piece and you know, voice your opinion on certain players in fear of what somebody may say. So it's a, you know, a lot of people throw around the word culture, but it is a good work environment, work culture. And that stems from him.
All right. Great to catch up with Mike. I want to, you know, Jay, I always ask you about takeaways after you have these. And I wanted to kind of just state a little bit from talking to Mike. You know, I just think one thing he talked about is finding, you know, the concept of finding these right guys and understanding how personality and the type of player you want fits in this room and how that's sort of blossomed. And, you know, my question being, has your attitude on that changed after watching what's happened the last 2 years and how much of an effect that has had? And he pointed out, no, this has really been a 4-year process of valuing that, going back to the beginning of the Zach Taylor age. You now are just starting to see it really come to fruition. You've always wanted to do it. You've always wanted to value that. But I think what has stood out is how much when you really value it, when you really put it to the forefront, and it can pay off for you. And I think that's something that you've seen happen with this personnel staff since they've kind of, you know, reconstructed and taken that on over the entire tenure. And it showed big time in this year's team.
Yeah. And I wonder, because yes, it's something they've been invested in for 4 years and trying to build this culture. But when it gets to this point now, can you maybe go after a guy that doesn't quite have that? You don't expect a rookie that's going to come in and rock the boat. He may not have all that personality, every box checked, but you get him in and they see what the rest of the locker room is like, and they kind of get in line, so to speak. And so I do wonder how much that they would be willing to stray from that now that the culture is not, it's in place. It's not being built.
And you saw that last year. I mean, we talked about, I remember Zach Taylor during the combine and pre-free agency talking about, you know, you're a little bit more willing, maybe in a spot here or there. I think we saw that a little bit in Lyle Collins, someone that you feel like you can take a little bit of a chance on that maybe someone in the league isn't, because Frank Pollock, right? And you feel like you've got an insight into that. You've got some reason to believe in whoever that personality is that maybe some in the league are questioning. I think that's part of it, where you can drop it in spots because the culture is so good, but you still, I think when you're drafting where Potts is coming from, I think you're still talking about that as such a big part of your core that's really so much of what matters most. The other thing, talking about Duke Tobin, and it struck me when you talk about somebody who's not all flash, about the work, kind of fits the team, no ego comes up again. I mean, it's really, there's a position, and a lot of these guys will be standing on the podium in Indianapolis in a week, in a month, at the end of this month. There is a lot of ego, coaches, GMs, my way or the highway. And we've talked about this across the coaching staff a lot, right? Like we talk about that, how they've built it that way. It stems from Duke too, who really, since the beginning, I mean, in the fact that he's never wanted to chase some high profile GM gig. He's never wanted to leave Cincinnati. He's never demanded a title of general manager, even though he basically has it. You know, he's never wanted to be out in front of all the interviews. He does it because he feels like he should. And is happy to point out that any of the, like, guys like Mike, like Steven, put yourself out there. That's, you know, talk to us anytime. Right. But doesn't have to be the same with himself. Doesn't seek that for himself. Right. I mean, I think that's a big part of the entire thing and why he's meshed so well with Zach Taylor.
And I mean, you can even extend that further to Joe Burrow. He's not, you know, the same thing. He's not out there chasing all these endorsements and trying to get flashy commercials. And he's the same way as Duke. He's all about the ball, all about football. And it just goes back to, you know, I know a lot of people kind of rolled their eyes with all the culture talk when Zach Taylor came in, but he has walked the walk. They have really built something here that ripples through the entire organization. It's not just the locker room. And I think there's a lot to that. And if there was a guy that deserved to maybe flash a little ego, it would be Zach after all the slings and arrows he took early. And then he's gone to back to back AFC championship games and a Super Bowl. And he has turned this thing around. And that's just never going to be who he is. He's going to get up on the podium in Indianapolis and he's going to sound a lot like he did that first year in 2019.
Yeah. And, you know, they've got some decisions in front of them now as they start. We outlined last week, you know, my 3-part series is still up now. You can choose to give it a read or you can just read whatever the internet says. I'm sure it's all right. and you can, you know, there's so many different ins and outs to where they go next. And it is different when you're talking about sustaining, comparing to building a little bit. You start becoming much more cap aware, much more contract aware than you have been, where you've had the freedom. I mean, they've had the freedom. How do we got to fix this problem? We can fix it by paying for it, or we can fix it by drafting for it, right? Mm-hmm. Now you might not have as much of the luxury to go out and fix things by paying for it. The good news is you have the base in place where you don't feel like you need to do that as much. It does change things a little bit. All right, let's just take a quick break.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jay, you took a look. This is something, this was kind of a reader question, right? Yeah. A reader wanting to know a little bit, can you do a little bit of Jay's Got Stats research here for us on quarterback contracts in the Super Bowl and the conference championship games? What'd you pull up?
Yeah, so thanks to William Jacob for this idea. I just went back 10 years because 10 seasons gets you back to 2013, and that is, I know this is very convoluted, what's being shown on the screen right now. Basically, if it's green, it's a guy on a rookie deal. And if it's red, it's a guy that was either making at least $20 million per year, or when you get back in the 16, 15, 14 years, when the cap was much lower, a guy making 10% of the salary cap, at least 10% of the salary cap. And it's, there's a good mix. I mean, five of the 20 quarterbacks, Super Bowl quarterbacks on this list did it on rookie deals, including Burrow last year. 9 of the 20 were making $20 million a year, or at least 10% of the cap. And then Tom Brady twice and Cam Newton were in that 9% range. They were just on the cusp. So those were big deals. The outliers are Mahomes in 2020. He was only making 5.3 as early after signing that extension. Nick Foles was making $1.6 million in 2017 when he won the Super Bowl. He started the year as a backup. And then the one that, if you look, the one in yellow there, that is almost an ideal Burrow comp. That's Jared Goff, and that was his fourth year. So it was supposed to be the final year of his rookie deal, but he signed the big extension. Leading up to that, I don't remember when exactly he signed it, but in that offseason between year three and year four. And so he was making considerably more overall, but that season it was still just $10 million. That's what, you know, Paul, you've talked about that, where they're still going to be on that rookie window for a couple years, even after Burrow signs a deal. But I thought that was interesting because Jared Goff, that was Zach Taylor's team. That was the 2018 Rams, and just a direct comparison of what the Bengals are going to be talking about this year with when Burrow's number spikes a little bit. The right two columns are the championship game runner-ups, Again, a lot of green in there and a lot of red. And then there's just a few outliers. Case Keenum was making $2 million a year when he took the Vikings. Carson Palmer was on a three-year, $49.5 million deal. But that year that he took the Cardinals to the championship game, he was only making 7.4. And then Ryan Tannehill was making 5.4 one year. But even when these quarterbacks are making these huge contracts, what you see in the red there, it's if you have a organization that can manage the cap well, which the Bengals have done for years, it's not cap hell. And you can still make these runs deep into the postseason if you structure everything else correctly around it.
Or if your name is Manning or Brady. Yes.
Yeah. Or Mahomes.
I think that's the important part of this. And you're going to, I think you scared the living crap out of Bengals fans saying, Jared Goff is your Burrow comp. And I know you didn't mean it like that, but that goes back to a story I did before the season started about what's the future of Joe Burrow when you look at how he compares to others that have started the way that he has. And Jared Goff was in there. Jared Goff had a really nice first few years, but once the money went up and he didn't have the same team around him and a lot of other things happened, he went off the pack. And the difference being, and everyone you talked to was these certain guys that continue, that the path getting harder doesn't take them out of the picture. It comes back to how they're wired, how they approach it, and them kind of being transcendent players. The Mahomes, the Mannings, the Bradys, those are the guys that you need to think about. And I think people, Bengals fans, I know, and they rightfully should think of Burrow in that vein and that's again why you can say, is it harder? Sure. Of course it's harder when you have that much less money down the road to put into the rest of the team. But those guys have, like Jay just showed there, transcended and found ways to get past it. All right. We're going to get more into some of the other stuff there. First of all, let's take a dive into AJ Green, who retired yesterday, announced his retirement on Instagram, as only he can. Man of few words, just a quick word that he's done. Thanks to everybody that helped him along the way, and he's kind of off into the sunset. I thought nobody better to talk about AJ Green with than our good friend Mo Egger. So let's go to Mo. All right, excited to once again bring our good friend and yours, Mo Egger of ESPN 1530, into the program live from New Orleans, Louisiana. How is New Orleans, Mo?
It's awesome. It's my favorite city. I love it here. I enjoy it. Lots to do.
There is lots to do. How was the food last night? Where'd you go to eat?
I went to a place. It's my favorite place here. It's called Port-au-Call, right?
Yeah.
It's on the edge of the French Quarter. It's known for their burgers and known for their cocktails. It's real old school. It's like walking into 1952. So I'm a huge Port-au-Call guy. So went there, and then I bounced around the city. We'll say that.
Yeah, there's no other way to go. Correct. Around the city.
Yeah. Yes.
We got a couple of different things. First of all, we're going to get to important Super Bowl bets and props and things like that here in a minute, because we have an important betting season to finish off and see who emerges victorious. But first of all, I want to ask you about this. There's like a million different ways to frame this when we talk about someone's career, and everybody we instantly want to go to like listicles and rankings and things like. I don't want to do that because I don't like doing that. It's not fair. What stands out most to you about AJ Green's career?
2011 was an extraordinarily chaotic time for the Bengals. It wasn't a very fun time to be a Bengals fan for 1,000 different reasons. They were coming off maybe their most unlikable team in 2010. There was a real bottoming out. That was the year where tens of thousands of season ticket holders turned against the team. Carson Palmer asked for a trade, and ESPN ranks them as the worst franchise in all of sports. And there was also a lockout. So all this stuff was happening, and yet there could really be no movement with regard to the roster. It felt like the draft itself was an afterthought, and it was occurring against the backdrop of all this uncertainty. So much so that I barely remember talking about AJ Green before he was drafted. I barely remember talking about who they were going to take in the first round. The conversation was about what are they going to do with Carson Palmer, And then when they finally drafted a quarterback, what's going to happen? Is Andy Dalton going to be the guy? It was a really rough time to be a Bengals fan, and I'm sure a really rough time to have worked for that franchise. They had the press conference from hell, 27 minutes of misery, Marvin, Mike announcing the extension. And AJ Green, I think more than anybody else, and I would include Andy Dalton in this conversation, more than anybody else, helped us turn the page from that and emerged as this guy that you're like, all right, well, whatever happens with this franchise, whatever your criticisms are, you can build around that guy. And he was the exact opposite of what they had had at wide receiver. And look, Chad Ochocinco, Chad Johnson is the greatest wide receiver in Bengals history statistically. I don't think anybody, you can't mathematically dispute that. And he made the franchise cool. But there was also a, boy, the act is worn thin. Can I get a guy who is as good but is not a headache? That was AJ Green. I mean, that's what everybody said in 2011, right? Like, man, this guy's just as good. But you're not getting the baggage. And so I the first thing that comes to mind when I think of AJ is just how he enabled us as fans to kind of move on and talk about something good during a period of time when there wasn't a lot of good. That franchise was an embarrassment. Carson Palmer embarrassed it. That season in 2010 was miserable, more miserable than anything they've done since or prior. And AJ, more than anybody else to me, allowed us to start talking about something good, something worth building around, and the career that he had ended up living up to the early hype. That's what I think of. I think of individual moments, but more than anything, I think of that 2011 season and how this wide receiver from Georgia emerged as kind of the anti-Chad and somebody around whom the Bengals could build and somebody that we could get excited about when there wasn't a lot to be excited about with this franchise.
And it was right from the jump. I mean, his first game as a pro, he catches a game-winning touchdown late in the fourth quarter. It was his only catch of that game, but it did. It really just kind of took off right from the start.
Caught it from
Bruce Gradkowski.
Yes, that's right.
If you distill his career down, its most memorable moment, I think everybody would pick the fight against Jalen Ramsey because it was so, I mean, it was so out of character, and that's why it was so memorable. But was there a game or a catch? Was there like a game that in your mind, Mo, was the quintessential AJ Green game?
Week 16, 2012 was an absolute matching of the nitwits in terms of coaching. Marvin Lewis and Mike Tomlin did what they could to give the game to the other guy. And so they go to Heinz Field. If they win, they're in. If they lose, I don't think they're eliminated, but they need some stuff to happen. So it felt like a playoff game. They had gotten off to a rough start. I think they were 2-5 or 2-6. They win a bunch of games, put themselves in a position. They go to Heinz Field, and the game is just awful. And I think Ben Roethlisberger throws a pick, if I'm not mistaken. The Bengals get it back, and in one play, they move into Josh Brown field goal range. And the one play was like a 21, 22-yard pass from Andy Dalton to A.J. Green. Andy was not good that day. A.J. was. Went well over 100 yards, if my memory serves me correct, and I think it does. But I remember kind of thinking to myself, like, all right, this is where number 18 is going to have to make a play, put this game in field goal range, because if this thing goes to overtime, God knows what these two coaches are going to do. We're going to have a tie. That's going to be unfulfilling. I don't know why, because somebody asked on Twitter what moment comes to mind. The moment that should come to mind is the playoff catch against the Steelers, which should be this iconic moment in this momentous victory. There should be a statue of that play. Unfortunately, the Bengals lost the football game because of a series of events that AJ had nothing to do with. That should be the moment, but you know, there were all the games he had against Baltimore. There was the season opener in 2014 when he had the juggling catch right after I think Steve Smith scored to give Baltimore the lead. But for whatever reason, the first thing that I thought of, because it's one of my favorite Bengals victories ever. It's basically beating the Steelers in a playoff game at Heinz Field, capping off a season that was really clunky to start, really fun at the end, and AJ made the biggest play in that game, at least offensively. That's what I think of the most. 2 weeks later, they played a playoff game, and they chose not to throw him the football in the entire first half. That's a different story, I guess. But that's the play that to me comes to mind more than any other.
Can I sum up the aesthetic appeal of that game in one stat line?
Yeah.
Ben Jarvis Green Ellis, 15 carries, 14 yards, long of four. Long of four. Oh, that was just keep shoving it in there. Eventually, yeah. You'll pop one, right? I think it was, AJ had 10 for 116 in that game.
Yeah.
A 21 yarder to set up the Josh Brown.
And it was like a 13-10 or 16-13 or something. But I remember the game. It was the first time I ever watched a Bengals game with my current wife. And so, boy, that was fun for her, I'm sure. But yeah,
she's still here.
Yeah. Josh Brown was the special teams player of the month in his 1 month as a Bengal.
That's
because
right.
Because he made, you know, in part because
all
he made
stopper ganger.
That's
yeah,
right.
Looks, does that's look right. Like me. But the AJ Green catch to set up the kick, for whatever reason, when that question was posed on Twitter yesterday, that's the first one that comes to mind. Also, you can't talk about AJ without referencing just his mastery of the Baltimore Ravens. I mean, he was at his best in those games. He was incredible. I was looking at his game logs yesterday, and it's like, man, he was as statistically, he was as good against Baltimore as I remember.
I tweeted this yesterday, but I specifically remember listening to the soundbite of John Harbaugh after a game saying, I mean, one of these years we're going to cover this guy. I mean, and just being just so sick of it. But to me, you know, the answer to that question to me is that there isn't a moment. And it is real. The realization, whenever it was along that line, whether it was an 11 or 12 of I have the luck of getting to watch this guy every single week, because every week he'd do something that made you gasp of just like, oh my goodness. And then when you go back, and I tweeted out the video, it's like 21 minutes long of just his best of highlights. It reminds you of every week there was one of those. Every week there was some one-hander around a guy or leaping up with a miracle toe drag on the sidelines. He's just such a freak, or the like unbelievable ball track of an underthrown deep ball, which, you know, was very rare occurrence, but, you know, and coming back and jumping over top of a couple people to do it, or, you know, the Hail Marys. I mean, all of that stuff, every single week there was one of those. And if there wasn't, you were stunned. And to me, it was the totality of that, of just how remarkable he was as far as the beauty with which he played, the unbelievable athleticism that he showed every single week, and always making you gasp at least once a game.
The only thing that could stop AJ Green was the Welcome Stadium turf.
No, oh, come on.
Oh, man. Damn.
It did end poorly, unfortunately.
But you referenced, you know, the times he would have to make an adjustment. I mean, it's hard, and you don't do it as a slight against Andy, but you just wonder, what does AJ Green's career look like if he plays with, you know, a genuine A-lister quarterback? What if he played with a guy that had Carson Palmer's physical talents? What if he played, you know, he was here his rookie season, but what if he played the bulk of his career with Joe Burrow? And it's no knock on Andy, but, you know, he had a ridiculously good career and statistically significant career, but he never played with a great quarterback. And you always, I mean, we did that often during his prime. Like, man, how good would this guy be if he wasn't always having to contort himself to catch a ball that wasn't, you know, right in the numbers? And it's you can say that and still appreciate. It's hard to talk about Andy without AJ. It's hard to talk about AJ without talking about Andy Dalton, because they ended the league at the same time. They won so many games together. But what if the Andy part is somebody who just physically is a better quarterback? Then what kind of career are we talking about?
I mean, I just, when you think about that 5-year stretch of percentage of times that Bengals fans left then Paul Brown Stadium happy because of a win, and talking about how unbelievable it was what they just saw AJ Green do, that was a big number. It was a high percentage of times, and I think that is something that to me should be the lasting legacy of that era, even though a lot of people don't want it to be. To me, that's what it is. It was watching AJ Green do miracle things and that team winning a lot of games because of it.
Yeah, he was incredible, and that you talked about that video and how it seemed like every game, there's a lot of those games or a lot of those highlights on that video where it was the same game where he had his career highlights are two or three plays in the same game. I'm with you, Paul. It was a treat to be able to watch him. And he was a great locker room guy too. He wasn't, he wasn't the greatest quote, but he was always accessible, and he was good to deal with. In our line of work, that's something that we always appreciate as well.
He was the quintessential. When he said something that needed to be said, it had been said. Right. Everybody took notice, whether it was about the offensive coordinator, whether it was about the way the offensive line is playing. After a game, AJ Green, if something needed to be said, would be the one to say it, and it would be the one person that could say it and make a massive impact on everyone. That was always, you know, he was always there to say something after a game, and if it was something serious, it mattered.
When they whacked Ken Zampezi, I remember that Thursday night, the next day, reading the AJ Green quote and talking about it on the air, going, you know, this is AJ Green saying this. This isn't some, you know, showboat me first wide receiver who's popping off after every game, who's just saying stuff just to say stuff. This, if AJ Green says the play calling is no good, I'm going to say the play calling is no good, and it's time to move on. And they did. Should get Ken Zampezi on your podcast to talk about AJ Green.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Mental units.
I'm sure he would. Let's move it on to our bet segment. Let's recap where we're at, Jay, as we enter. This is it. This is the last fake bets for fake monetary units that we're going to do to conclude this season and wrap it up. Where does it stand as we know what people need to get?
Okay, so Paul's in the lead at 221.7 units. I'm in second at 197.6 units, and Mo is right behind me in third at 195.4. Paul has a future bet still on Doug Peterson being coach of the year. Mo has a future bet still on Brian Daboll being coach of the year.
So that is on there. And then whatever we do, so we'll same thing. You've got 20 units to spread across the Super Bowl. Mo, what have you got?
Am I allowed to just make two bets, or can I?
Yeah.
Can I just give you what I have?
Whatever you want. Whatever you want.
All right. I think Philly's going to win the game. I'm going to go Philadelphia money line. So if you think Philly's going to win the game, then you should bet on their quarterback to be the MVP, Jalen Hurts plus 130. But Jalen Hurts statistically, I'm not sure is going to look. You're going to look at his numbers and be wowed. So I'm going to take a flyer, because I got some catching up to do here on the Miles Sanders MVP plus 2,500. I have also got a prop for Miles Sanders to lead the game in rushing yards at plus 175. And I've got the Chiefs calling the first time out because it's Andy Reid. He might call one after the opening coin flip. That's at minus 115. You could do with all that what you please. But if you want to make it two, let's go Miles Sanders MVP and Philly to win the game and cover the number.
It's been 25 years since a running back won MVP in the Super Bowl. Terrell Davis was the last one to do it. So I'm going the other way. I'm going to parlay Chiefs plus 1.5 and the over 50.5 for 10. And then I'm going to do a 10 unit bet on Travis Kelce scoring the first touchdown, which is plus 700. That seems crazy high for him. He is the leader to do it, but that's still, that seems like a pretty good value there. If they get down there, you know the ball's going to him.
All right. I will I'll do 10 on the Chiefs to win straight up. And I will also throw in a fiver on Jerick McKinnon anytime TD, which is going off at plus 160 right now. Just kind of playing it nice and safe here. You know, just trying to just stack a little bit. I'm going to throw an extra five in on the Gatorade color being orange, which is at plus 300. Thanks to our fancy schmancy research that our people did, they have, going back the last 20 years, the color of the Gatorade at every single time. And three of the last four have been blue. But the only one that was orange of the last four was the last time the Chiefs one. So if the Chiefs, I got to think they're using the same color Gatorade. I can't believe they've changed their Gatorade philosophy over the course of recent years. So if the Chiefs win, which I'm predicting, the Gatorade color should be orange. Or do you think they have multiple colors on the sideline?
Well, I think what you have to look into is what would the color have been the year they lost to Tampa Bay?
We'll never know.
Never going to know.
We'll never
know. I mean, do we assume that Gatorade would have been or was
I'm just going
orange?
With what I've got. I've got that okay. It was orange the last time it was poured out from Kansas City. Went same coaching staff. I think the same Gatorade guy. I'm just gonna guess that.
Don't you feel like one day there's going to be a massive NFL gambling scandal where the guy in charge of the Gatorade is going to be revealed to have, you know, been making wagers, maybe through his buddies, on what color the Gatorade? Like, I know there's very strict anti-gambling rules for NFL personnel, but if you're the Gatorade guy, how do you not go to all your friends? Right? Like, I wonder this all the time about people who bet on professional wrestling. Like, if you're the guy that writes the script for professional wrestling, knowing you can take wagers on it, how are you not? You're literally the guy who determines who wins. Well, if you're the Gatorade guy, you maybe can't, you know, have an account, but your brother can, your buddies can. One day, this is going to reveal itself, and there's going to be a massive scandal. And it's going to bring the NFL to its knees.
I merely hope that I'm here to write it because I cannot wait for that possibility. Mo, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy New Orleans this afternoon and the UC Bearcats this evening. And we will we'll catch up with you next week and we will revisit who ended up victorious in our completely fake, not for anything.
It's going to be awesome.
Dream. All right. Later, Mo.
See you guys.
Thanks, Mo.
All right. Great catching up with Mo J as he is about to go back out. I'm so jealous. I want to go hit New Orleans up. I miss it. That was one of my favorite trips we had this year. We didn't really do any good year in review honors. But if I always like to throw best road trip in there, it would be pretty hard to beat New Orleans. It'd be pretty hard to beat New Orleans. That was a pretty unbelievable trip.
I wasn't on that one. So
sorry, Jay.
Yep. Tampa was a good trip. And what Mo was talking about with the Gatorade guy, maybe some inside information. I'm surprised they do. I mean, is there an easier bet to win than length of national anthem? I mean, the guy that's singing it, Chris Stapleton this year, he knows exactly how long it's going to be. He could easily tell people. And the thing with those prop bets, though, I do think a lot of them are capped. It's not like someone can, like Mattress Mack, can go put $1 million or whatever on those. I think those oftentimes are capped at $500 or $1,000. But still, if you go tell a bunch of people that you're going to hit the anthem in 122, people could win. You get a nice little chunk of change that you can play with in the rest of the game.
You would know that about caps on the Gatorade props. Right up your alley. All right. Let's get to Arby's, Jay, shall we?
Yeah.
I'll start. How should I start this?
I can just sit back and listen for a bit because I feel a rant's coming.
No. It's weird. Like, so, okay, when you're in our profession, in the way the internet is structured these days, if you have big news, or you feel like you have broken some kind of interesting news or some observation that's important, that you're reporting, it can go viral in a hurry. You can become the talk of the internet for a minute. And a lot of times, I'm not going to say that's the goal, but it's not bad. If it's something that you've worked hard on, that you've reported, and you stand by it, and that's great. Maybe the most frustrating thing, and I think players commiserate with this the same way. The most frustrating thing is to feel like something that you don't stand by, that you didn't say, or like players say, oh, I was taken out of context or whatever it was, is churned out, shoved into the internet funnel, and it just ends up, it's out of control, right? And there's nothing you can do about it. There really isn't. And that's what happened with the T. Higgins conversation on Friday. I'm just trying to have a nice little Friday, Jay. First Friday of the off season. Here we go. Weekend. Gonna get that first weekend. You know, the path to the off season path series in the pocket. It's done. Everything's been out for a day and a half. We're feeling free and clear. Making my plans to, you know, have a nice dinner, take the kids out. It's going to be fantastic. And next thing you know, the internet is going nuts claiming that myself, working apparently for The Atlantic, said that the Bengals could trade T. Higgins. They're going to trade T. Higgins. He's making outrageous demands, Jay. And it gets shoved out into the internet, and everybody believes that that is what is happening. When in actuality, anybody that listened to this podcast last week, I went back and re-listened to us last week. I made sure to reread everything that I wrote 10 times. See, could this be misconstrued? It never at any... The whole point of the offseason path was laying out what's in front of the Bengals. As they sit down to make their decision, what is in front of them? And with T. Higgins is, okay, he is entering this portion of the program that we've seen receivers enter as he's extension eligible. Can they extend him? What is the precedent here that has happened in the past? Can they get that deal done? It's the same agent as Jesse Bates. Are they going to play this out the same way as it did with Jesse Bates, who stayed, but they kind of haggled for a number of times? Can you pay Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins and Joe Burrow all simultaneously? Laying out this is what's in front of them, pointing out this could be things they have to think about, all of these options. At no point is it saying they are going to trade T. Higgins or they're having serious discussions about doing this. You just have to think about these things, okay? And now all of a sudden it's this huge thing, and people are like, the Bengals are trading T. Higgins, and then Dan Orlovsky's on ESPN like, oh man, go Bears, go get them. And it's like, you know, and everybody latches on from their corners of the internet, and it's just way out of control. It's frustrating because I can tweet out, for those that want to read, here's exactly what it said, and everyone can know that, but not half the people, maybe more, that are the average person who isn't following where it comes from, has no idea that was completely, essentially fabricated and thrown out there. And that's very, very frustrating. Jay, if you have anything you want to say about it for a second, you can, and I'll hop back into a little bit more nuanced portion of the conversation while I drink some water.
Well, I agree with everything you said. It's just the way that a lot of these aggregators work now. But my question for you is, on Friday, when you were trying to have a good day and this thing starts blowing up, how many tweets did you have composed that you did not send?
Okay. 5 to 6.
Oh, wow.
At where I dialed back and it was like, okay, am I going to go after the person? Do I want to at them? I was like, no, I don't want to at them. I don't want to give them the attention they crave. They want it out of this. I don't want to make it worse. And then I was like, am I mean? Well, you want to be like a certain level of pissed off, but you don't want to show people how pissed off you maybe are. And then I just want people to read and understand what it actually said, which is where I ended up landing. But it does take a few drafts and a couple calls to editors to make sure that we're all cool on the up and up on how we attack this. Cause this stuff happens. I mean, stuff happens, especially when you're behind a paywall, this stuff happens. Here's one thing I want to talk about. And if I have a regret over the way the story was written, is that I didn't lay this all the way out. Cause again, we were trying to just do a quick snapshot. I wasn't trying to go all the way deep into all the nuance of the history here. Let me say this. Here's why talking about it. I'm not saying the Bengals would do this. And in fact, they're not going to, like, they're trying to win a championship. Like we said, with T. Higgins, he's great. The same way, follow the Jesse Bates path. We talked about all of that. But when people call and you talk about precedent, here's what it is. Last year, there were five receivers who were entering the extension eligible portion of their contract, who had been big name receivers who had over 3,000 yards and double digit touchdowns and were viewed as legit dudes. Okay. They were AJ Brown in Tennessee, who was a second round pick, DK Metcalf in Seattle, who was a second round pick, Deebo Samuel in San Francisco, who was a second round pick, Terry McLaurin in Washington, who was a third round pick, and Marquise Brown, in Baltimore, who was a first-round pick. Of those five, two were traded. Three were extended. None played on their rookie deal, fourth year in the rookie deal. AJ Brown requested a trade. Got it. DK Metcalf, all, none of these people showed up at any of the offseason and made big deals of the fact that they were not appearing at any offseason program portion stuff. DK Metcalf was certainly vocal about not being happy with the fact he hadn't gotten a deal. Deebo Samuel requested a trade very publicly. Terry McLaurin did not request a trade, but did not appear at any of the offseason program. Marquise Brown requested a trade. All of these people played that card, right? So that's a card. That, I mean, that's kind of what the situation is when you're talking about guys in this situation just last year. The same situation that T. Higgins, CeeDee Lamb, and Justin Jefferson are entering into this year. And what happens? Again, they all get extensions. Two of them get traded. A.J. Brown traded on draft day. Immediate extension by the Eagles. He's playing in the Super Bowl. Tennessee's GM got fired. Marquise Brown traded to Arizona. He didn't like the system as much as they couldn't come to a deal. Eric DaCosta talks about how he grinded over this decision for months. Eventually did end up making the deal. They selected Tyler Linderbaum with the first round pick they got from Arizona as part of that. He play on the fifth year option, or he has the fifth year option for next year. He did not receive an extension. Metcalf got his extension on July 28th after Metcalf and Samuel both did a hold ins in training camp. They showed up and refused to participate. Joe Mixon did this a couple years ago, hold in. We've seen that happen before. Metcalf and Samuel both did hold ins and eventually signed deals, very similar ones, both 3 years, a little over $70 million. DK Metcalf with 58 guaranteed, Deebo Samuel with 41 guaranteed. Terry McLaurin did his deal in mid-July or early July, right after the 4th. And it was similar, 3 years, a little under $70 million, a little over 54, a little about $54 million guaranteed. Again, that's the setup. So the idea that this is the these are the precedents that are going to be worked off of by T's agent and by the Bengals is what's in front of you. To say that you have to be prepared for all possible things that could happen here, including hold-ins, trade requests, extensions given, are all part of what they're going through and weighing at this point. They want to win championships. They want to do it with T. Higgins. That is the far likeliest scenario. I hate that I have to continue to say it, but I want to make sure we say it clear as day. They have no desire to trade T. Higgins. They fully expect this, I'm sure, to end up a lot like, hopefully without the hold-ins, probably more like Terry McLaurin did, right? Try to sign something early in the offseason, get it done, and put him away. If it's 3 years, $75 million, get it done in July. I think everybody would be happy with that. Will that happen? I don't know. Nobody knows. We'll see. But they'll happily, if it doesn't, tell him we love to see you in the fall catching a pass on opening day from Joe Burrow.
Yeah, the one area where maybe he's not a comp to those other guys, all those other guys are the wide receiver one on their teams.
Yeah.
And he is not. And so, and Mike Brown doesn't blink. And then, again, I'm not going down that road where this is what the path that T's going to take. But the other thing I took away from this is that the people that were aggregating it incorrectly, if you were reporting what they thought you were reporting, don't you think that would have been in the lead, would have been in the headline? I mean, it was way down in the story where you got to the whole T. Higgins situation.
Under extension and candidates.
Yes, exactly. So it was just a fail on the part of some people. And like you said, once it gets out there in the Twitter sphere, it can just catch fire, and it did. And it was unfortunate because it makes, whether you reported it that way or not, people assume you did. Perception is reality, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I could almost hear you seething all the way up here in Hamilton.
You know, you just, it happens, right?
Yeah.
It happens. And it's, I guess, no more laying out the path, no more laying out what's in front of teams, I guess, is maybe that's the moral of the story. So that's my Arby's. That was my Friday. Yeah. Pretty nice little Friday.
Mine came Thursday. Mine came the day before that. It was a much more fun one. It was watching Trey Hendrickson in the Pro Bowl games. I know a lot of people thought the Pro Bowl games were dumb, and I don't think viewership was real good. But I was thoroughly entertained watching him catch punts. And for people that didn't watch, at first they had to catch a punt with one ball in their hand, and then two, and then three, and then four. And I believe he was the only AFC guy, and he might have been the only guy, period, that was able to catch the fifth ball while holding four. Trey Hendrickson, by the way, has never held a football in a game. He has no fumble recoveries. He has no interceptions. He's gotten his hand. He's got his hand on, I think, five or six career pass deflections. But this is a guy, and I remember, you know, Pac-Man used to do this all the time. He would see how many he could hold in training camp practices and catch them off the jugs and see how many he could catch while holding other ones. And then Darren Simmons actually had guys do kind of a variation of that as a regular drill, where they would either hold one and then throw it up in the air to the other hand and then catch it with the hand that was previously holding one, or just intentionally catch a punt one-handed. And I know other guys that aren't punt returners go out there and sometimes do it in training camp and have fun. I've never seen Trey Hendrickson out there fielding punts, and I was thoroughly entertained with his ability to show up everybody else. And it was a lot of linemen. It was a lot of guys that weren't used to catching balls, period. But I was really impressed and entertained with that small part of the Pro Bowl games.
Yeah. And I guess his wrist's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you get you also get Ja'Marr Chase scoring a touchdown and throwing the ball to T. Higgins, which I did enjoy. Yeah. For his buddy out there. And I really enjoyed Tyler Boyd and T. Higgins in the suite having a good old time. If you follow them on Instagram. And Tyler Boyd trying to give Ja'Marr Chase a drink during the Pro Bowl, and Ja'Marr being like, oh, guess I shouldn't. And he tweeted out later, you know, thinking about that check. Want to make sure I didn't sacrifice any getting my Pro Bowl checks or any of that stuff there. So did not take a drink from TB, who was in the suite. I love the Bengals getting the suite right by the end zone, though, there in Allegiant Stadium. Good time. Also, they weren't the only ones there. Pictures going around. Joe Burrow, Jesse Bates, Chidobe Awuzie, Jake Browning meeting up with their friends with Nick Bosa, George Kittle. They're all kind of together at one point. But weirdly, these AFC Championship game losing teams managed to congregate. I know Bosa, very close friends with Burrow, wrote about that in the Hubbard Burrow friendship story, but kind of fun to see all of them hanging out together in Vegas over the weekend. All right. Bengals growler bet. Here, you know what? I have a run passer boot that I was going to throw in here just to add on to the Higgins thing. And make sure we sneak one in here. Opening day. T. Higgins is extended, has been extended. He is playing on a rookie deal. Oh, hold on. My dog wants to say hi to everybody here real quick. So I think there's a mailman.
Mail delivery.
Yeah, mail's here. Made it today. That's good news. Uncle Phil's going to scare him away. So run passer boot. T. Higgins on opening day is playing, fully extended and playing, playing on his rookie deal, or not playing in the game for any number of reasons, for the Bengals at least. Run, pass, or boot?
Well, I'm going to boot not playing for the Bengals. I don't see that happening. Yeah. And then the other two, I could see it going either way. I don't know if they feel, because they definitely want to keep Ja'Marr around. Do they feel like they can keep Ja'Marr, Joe Burrow, and T. Higgins and still have a quality roster? I think I'm going to run with him being on his rookie deal. He has some leverage, but it's not as great as, like I said, he's not the number one guy like those other guys were. Mike Brown doesn't blink when guys try to do this holdout thing. So I'll run with T on his rookie deal. I'll pass on him being extended, and then I'll boot him being elsewhere.
Yeah. I just got to say, 5 for 5 last year and extensions getting done amongst that group. You mentioned he is different from those guys in a lot of ways, although DK Metcalf on a team with Tyler Lockett, there you can have discussions there. But, I mean, still, legit number one guys on those teams, despite all the posturing and talk. You know, Metcalf, Samuel, McLaurin, all extended. I'm going to run with extension, and pass on playing on the rookie deal and deep boot, hard boot, in not playing in the game for any number of reasons, non-injury related, of course. So but figure I'd throw that out there just for us to have on the record. All right, growler bet time, Jay. Super Bowl growler bet. Last one for a game this season.
Or you guys are, I'm sure the scabs are forming from the wound from the AFC Championship game. We're going to rip it right back off. And we're going to have a penalty and officiating related Bengals growler bet. You need to tell us the time of the first score negated by a penalty. So touchdown, pass, overturn, or there's a penalty on holding and it's called back. Anything that OPI, anything that negates a score, any penalty that negates a score, what is the time of game on that? And we didn't discuss this. What kind of buffer do we want to?
Let's go 5 seconds. Let's go 5 seconds either direction.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a Super Bowl, man. It's a party. Let's have fun.
Yeah, 5 seconds either way. So you got a 10-second window there to hit this. If you say there won't be one, then you need to tell us the total number of penalty yards in the game.
I think New York's going to be involved. So I think we're going to get a score where New York comes in and says, no, I don't think so, at some point. So I'm going to – it would be great as if it was a field goal that like went over top of a field goal post or something. I'd kind of like that. but that would count. Holding on a field goal attempt, maybe that, that would count too. Any score that is wiped out by a penalty or New York. I'm going to say – it's going to be big. It's going to be fourth quarter, and it's going to be with 7:52 in the fourth quarter is when we're going to see a score wiped out by a penalty, and we're going to see a rule change in March.
I don't know about a rule change. I feel like, too, and this goes back to that AFC Championship game where they didn't call the holding on the Chiefs. They didn't call the roughing the passer against Burrow. They do tend to swallow the whistles and hold onto the flags a little more late in these big games. The Osai one just couldn't be avoided, that they had to throw that flag there. I think I'm with you. I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be something early. I'm going to say 12:55 of the second quarter. Maybe one team jumps out to a 2-score lead and they're like, no, we need to keep this game a little closer. There's a phantom holding call that keeps it a 1-score game.
Jay, are we going to count holding in the end zone for a safety?
No, because that doesn't negate the score.
No, but it causes a score.
Well, it causes it, but this is a score negated by a penalty.
Yeah, I know, but I feel like it's a Carl Sheffers game, okay? It's if Sheffers interjects himself into scoring plays, is what I feel like, or whoever's answering the phones in New York these days.
Yeah.
All right, so we're on the record for those. That will wrap us up. Super Bowl Sunday is here. I don't know if Bengals fans are interested in the game, watching it, not watching it, choosing to hate watch it, rewatching the Bengals Bills game instead. I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do, but either way, enjoy yourself. Be safe wherever, if you're driving around or overindulging in Skyline dip. Don't eat too much. Hope you enjoy it. All right, Jay, this has been a fun episode. Sorry if I got too riled up.
No, you had a right to.
No, I don't want to get all riled up.
Yeah. It wasn't. I thought it was going to be a little angrier than it was. So
I've come down. If it would have been Friday, if we would have recorded on Friday, it would have been different. But we've tried to come down off that cloud. So. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you next time. Have a good one.
Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.